quantum information processing in general, and I'll talk a little bit about what that subject is about. Just a little small confession, and that is that, well, I guess I expected my first lecture to run considerably over and probably to defer part of it until the second, so I actually find myself strangely ahead of time at the moment. I expect we'll probably have maybe 10 minutes or so at the end for questions, so feel free to take advantage of that and note down any questions which you might have during the talk, or alternately feel free to interrupt. I guess I found it a little curious. In fact, somebody remarked to me over the break that they thought it was interesting that we're having a summer school but almost no questions whatsoever during the main body of the talk, so please feel free to interrupt at any time. Alrighty, I'll go on and finish the line of thought which we had at the end of the last lecture. We were talking about really how we made use of this black box for computing a classical function, but we didn't explain how you would necessarily implement that. How can you compute a classical function on a quantum computer? And the basic problem, as I've already alluded to, is that quantum gates are inherently reversible devices. Because a unitary transformation always has an inverse, which is itself another unitary transformation, you can always, from the output of a quantum gate, recover the input. That's simply not true for classical gates, such as the AND gate or the OR gate or many others which you can enumerate. The solution to this problem is to construct a type of embedding. You embed your irreversible classical gates in reversible quantum gates. And I'll give you an example of how this is done. And once you've seen the basic idea, it's very easy to generalize to other situations. The particular example I'm going to do is very important for us. It's the so-called quantum NAND gate. Now, some of you may not know what a NAND gate necessarily is. I'm sure you all know the AND gate. The AND of X and Y, of two bits, X and Y, is defined to be 1 if both bits are 1 and otherwise is 0. Well, the NAND gate is simply the knotted output of an AND gate. So it's the negation of the AND of the two bits. Let me show you a picture of how one would implement this using on a quantum computer. Very simple. What you do is you introduce some extra qubits into the picture. So here are the bits that you want to AND, X and Y. You introduce an extra quantum state in the state 1, so it's some standard state. We often refer to this as an ancilla state. I'm informed that the term ancilla means handmaiden. It's a handmaiden state. Then we apply the Toffoli gate with these two bits as the controls and the ancilla bit as the target. And, of course, this leaves the two controls alone, but it flips the target exactly when both X and Y are equal to 1. And if you look at this expression, well, what is this? X times Y is just the AND of X and Y, and if you add 1 modulo 2, then that negates X and Y, so this is the NAND of X and Y down here. So what you've done, of course, this is a reversible gate, as all quantum gates are reversible. Indeed, it's a simple exercise to verify that applying the Toffoli gate twice gets you back to the identity. So what we've done, however, is if you disregard this qubit and these two qubits, then this transformation from these two to this would appear to be irreversible. But by enlarging our system somewhat, we're able to construct a reversible transformation. Now, as far as physicists are aware, all the laws of nature are in fact reversible. So whenever we have a physical system, such as an AND gate or a NAND gate in a conventional computer, which appears to be irreversible, we would believe, therefore, that the actual underlying physical process is really reversible, and the reason why it appears irreversible is because we're disregarding some degrees of freedom. So this is a very simple example of how you can get an apparently irreversible process out of a reversible process by disregarding some degrees of freedom, and it's also, incidentally, a very nice way of being able to implement a NAND gate on a quantum computer. That's not quite the end of the story for how we simulate or how we compute classical functions on quantum computers. The other part of the story, well, we need to know a few facts about classical logic or about classical computers. In particular, any classical circuit whatsoever can always be written in terms of the NAND gate and one other operation, the so-called fan-out operation. So what's the fan-out the fan out of a single bit X is just defined to be the gate which produces an extra copy of X. So you have one gate, one copy of X going in, and you have two copies going out. And if you combine these two functions, NAND and fan out, then you can compute any function whatsoever. I won't show you the proof of that, but it's pretty easy to do by induction. So how do you do that in the case of a quantum circuit? Well, it's pretty easy. It involves just two qubits. Again, you've got this ancilla state, 0, and an input bit, X, which you want to fan out. And you simply apply a control NOT gate, which flips this second qubit, the control qubit, if and only if X was set to 1. So as a result, the output is just two copies of X. And there's your fan out. And as a result, we're able to simulate any classical circuit whatsoever using quantum gates, simply controlled knots and Toffolis, together with these ancilla operations or ancilla qubits. So let's just summarize. We've got a classical circuit. I'm going to introduce a few conventions here. This X might be many bits, n bits, say, and then we apply some circuit consisting of NAND gates and fan out, and we get, for example, a single bit of output. F of X. So we're going to imagine that F is a Boolean function. I could also extend to the case where F is not a Boolean function, where there are many bits of output. It doesn't really change things too much, but it'll be convenient to imagine that F is Boolean. What does the corresponding quantum circuit look like? Well, we just replace all of the elements in this classical circuit with their corresponding Toffoli gates, ancillas, and controlled knots in a quantum circuit, and I've explicitly written the ancillas in. So what goes in is the n qubit input X, and you get a single qubit output F of X, and you've got these ancillas going in, and potentially you have a whole lot of garbage coming out as well. Those correspond to those extra qubits that we weren't making any use of in the computation. For example, coming out of the Toffoli gate. Remember, we had the X and the Y came out and we just discarded. We didn't need them for the NAND. Well, so you have those extra sorts of garbage qubits coming out, which can potentially depend on X. This is the answer, but you also have some garbage coming out. There, for various reasons, it's in many instances desirable to eliminate these garbage qubits. In particular, you might recall that when I described the way the black box worked in the case of Deutsch's algorithm, there was no garbage lying around in this computation. There were no garbage qubits. We simply got F of X being produced by the black box. So how is it possible to eliminate the garbage bits? I'll explain how that's done right now. And in fact, I'll explain how you would implement the sort of operation I described in the last lecture. It's very simple. You have your input here, X. You have your ancilla qubits here. And you're going to have a single extra qubit, which I'll just label Z. It's a computational basis state. And we apply this circuit. So let's see what the action of the circuit is. The very first thing that happens, well, of course, we get F of X output here on this line, and we get the garbage state, G sub X, output here on this line. We then apply the control NOT, so the output up here is Z plus F of X. You might remember that that's what we assumed our black box did. It output Z plus F of X on the answer qubit. So this Z is going to play the role of the answer qubit in the black box model, which I described last time. The next thing we do then is we apply the inverse circuit. So I've written UF dagger. Remember, U sub F is a unitary operation, and therefore its adjoint is its inverse. So what we're going to do is I've got this circuit for computing U sub F. What I'm going to do is apply the circuit in reverse order. I'm simply going to take the inverse of all the operations and undo U sub F, and that's the way you construct the circuit which performs the operation inverse to U sub F. And what happens, of course, is that you simply get returned to the same states as were originally input, X and this zero state. And the important point to note here is that there's no longer any garbage in the computation. You've got X and Z going in, together with some standard ancilla state, and you've got x and z plus f of x coming out together with the ancilla, but it's in the same state as before, so there's no dependence at all on x. In other words, the net effect, if we ignore these ancilla qubits, which don't affect the computation at all, is to perform this transformation, xz goes to xz plus f of x, and this is in fact exactly the form in which we applied the black box last time. Sorry? It's a good question. There's a sort of a standard answer to that question. You know, when I described the way Deutsch's algorithm worked, I talked about the crucial role which interference played. You needed to be able to interfere the different terms in order to recover information about the global state or the global properties of the function. Turns out that if you include the garbage qubits, that interference goes away. The basic reason why is because the garbage acts as a record of the value of x, and you can't interfere terms with different values of x, and that's the basic problem. Well, that's the standard explanation. I'm not sure to what extent I actually believe that explanation. It's true at some level. I suspect that probably a much better answer would be possible if we understood what gave quantum computers their power. So, yeah, take that with a grain of salt. But that's the reason why. Well, that's the standard argument for why we don't want garbage in our black boxes. Yep. It's I think sort of a bit of background to this question, or to understand where the question comes from. Let me make just a couple of remarks. This is something of a digression, but the so we had this operation, one copy of x got turned into two copies of x, I claimed. There's a famous result in quantum information theory, the so-called no-cloning theorem, which says that if you're given a copy of an unknown quantum state, it's impossible to construct two copies of it. So you might wonder, well, how is that possible? There are two answers to that. One is, well, it's a unitary operation. You can write it down and verify that the control knot really does have that effect. The second is to look more closely at what the no-cloning theorem actually says. The no-cloning theorem actually says that it's impossible to construct a device which clones an unknown quantum state. Well, there's only two, or x, that the x which I had, which I was doing the fan-out of, was either 0 or 1, right? So there's only two quantum states that we want to be able to construct copies of. It's not an arbitrary quantum state that we're constructing a copy of, and that's all that the no-cloning theorem forbids. You can't construct a machine which will clone an unknown quantum state. So there's no problem at all.
What also is that you cannot clone all these things too, but you can, if you have any independence on them, repeating them would not be a constant. Linear combination would, because copying is not a linear operation. That's the core of the theory.
Sure.
So what would happen if you tried to copy 0 plus 1?
Well, you'd actually end up with an entangled state. If you tried to copy 0 plus 1 using that circuit, then it wouldn't work. That's the basic point. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mike. Alrighty. So this is the construction, or this is how you would turn your classical black box, or roughly, I've now outlined a procedure that will let you turn your classical black boxes for computing functions into quantum circuits for computing the appropriate function. And this is used, for example, in Shor's algorithm, where one wishes to perform modular exponentiation. And you take the classical circuit for doing modular exponentiation and turn it into a corresponding quantum circuit. Danny?
Is there a fundamental reason why you chose the
inverse of U as opposed to just measuring those extra qubits and re-initializing them by
Again, this has to do with the inference explanation. If you measure it, in some sense, there's still a record lying around somewhere, and it destroys the inference properties. That's the basic reason. Look, the only difference, if it's a non-Boolean function, is that you would have more qubits here to store the answer, and you'd have a whole slew of controlled knots there to add bitwise. But yeah, there's very little difference. Oh, yeah, sorry. Deutsch's algorithm is only supposed to apply to the case of a Boolean function, so that's not a problem at all. Mike will actually talk tomorrow about some more sophisticated examples in the case of Shor's algorithm, I believe. Okay. Righty, so that concludes the discussion of how you compute classical functions on quantum computers. What I want to talk about next is the general, very general question of what is quantum information theory exactly. When I, some time ago, when I was writing a little review of quantum information theory, I sat down and thought to myself, you know, what exactly is quantum information theory? And you go away and look at the Los Alamos preprint archive and ask, well, you know, what are the unifying features of all these papers that purport to be about quantum information? And at first glance, I think it appears that there's not a whole lot in common, except they all seem to talk a lot about qubits. Now, I have identified what I think are the three basic things in common with all of these papers, or what goals, common goals they have. So the first goal is to identify classes of static resources in quantum mechanics. So what's an example, or a few examples of this? To give you some idea, we've got things like, for example, qubits, obviously. Bits as well, because you know, bits really are fundamentally quantum mechanical objects, and you can understand them entirely in terms of quantum mechanics and all their properties. So that's certainly a type of static resource in quantum mechanics. And you've also got things like shared states. So when I talked about superdense coding before, we had this shared state that Bob set up a state, and then he sent part of it over to Alice, and they were able to use that state to perform some task that would not have been possible classically. Namely, Alice sending just the one qubit could communicate two bits of classical information. So these are various classes of static resources that have been identified and which are studied in quantum information theory. The second element which I want to talk about is classes of dynamical processes in quantum mechanics, so things that you can do to these static resources. And a few examples of these, well, a good, very good example is in fact quantum memory. One of the hardest things to do is to store a quantum state over some period of time. Typically they're very, very fragile sorts of objects, so you know, an interesting dynamical operation to perform to them is just the identity operation. It's actually quite a difficult thing to do. Copying, as was alluded to before. Information transmission over some sort of noisy channel is also a very interesting elementary class of dynamical process. And things like, you may, for example, wish, if you've got some source of information producing quantum states as signals, you may wish to ask the question, you know, what are the minimal physical resources I require to store this? This is a question which is analogous to that of classical data compression. You know, what is the limit, fundamental limit, on how much I can compress my quantum information source? So these are all examples of very simple classes of dynamical processes in quantum mechanics. And then the way a typical paper works, you know, once you've identified this and this, what you do is you quantify resource trade-offs incurred performing these elementary dynamical processes. So just to pick a very simple example, if you've got some noisy quantum channel, so you're sending quantum information from Alice over to Bob, and the channel unfortunately is introducing noise into the states, it's possible to use quantum error-correcting codes to protect against the noise, but there's a cost, in that you have to use the channel more times than you otherwise would. So what's the minimal number of times you need to use the channel in order to communicate a qubit reliably? That's an example of the sort of resource trade-off that occurs in performing these elementary dynamical processes in quantum mechanics. So I'll give you an example of this. We've actually already really worked through one good example, which was superdense coding. I'm going to work through another interesting example, that of quantum teleportation. So once again, we have our two characters, Alice and Bob, and they want to perform a particular type of task. It's actually going to be a type of quantum information transmission. So what Alice has in her possession is a quantum state psi. She's been given this state. She doesn't actually know what the state is, and she's not able to determine it. Remember, we're not able to determine the state exactly. We can't read off alpha and beta. Psi, I'm going to assume, is a qubit, although it's pretty easy to generalize all this discussion to more complicated systems. We're also going to assume that Alice and Bob share some entangled resource. It's going to be a 2-qubit state, and it will be, in fact, this particular state, 0, 0, plus 1, 1 over root 2. So there's 3 qubits involved here. One is Alice's state psi that she wishes to send over to Bob, and then there's this 2-qubit state which Alice and Bob have shared, quite possibly at some point in the long-distant past. In fact, some other person entirely, Victor, may have prepared the state 0, 0, plus 1, 1, sent half of it off to Alice and half of it off to Bob. So, in fact, Alice and Bob may never have communicated at all. The problem is that Alice wishes to send Psi over to Bob. The difficulty which they face in doing this, however, is that we're going to constrain them. There's no quantum communications channel which they can use to communicate. So there's no channel they can use to send the quantum information. We are, however, going to give them 2 resources. We've already given them 1 resource, which is this pre-shared state. And we're also going to give them the ability to communicate classically. And with these 2 resources, Alice and Bob, it turns out, can actually do this communication of qubit. So it's a very good example of the sort of resource trade-off you have. A shared state, this shared state, plus classical communication, turns out to allow you to do some other dynamical process, namely the transmission of a qubit. This is sort of very canonical in quantum information theory, the sort of question which is studied. Let me describe to you the protocol in somewhat more detail. Quantum teleportation was discovered in 1993, 60-odd years after quantum mechanics was discovered. It's rather interesting then that really the whole thing boils down to one line of algebra. I've written out this state up here. Yeah, we've got 3 qubits. It turns out that with just a little bit of algebra, you can rewrite this state in a form that enables you to basically see quantum teleportation. And verifying this identity, that this state I've written up here is in fact exactly equal to this state down there, is basically an undergraduate algebra exercise. So what I'm claiming is, the claim is that the state I've written up there for any psi whatsoever is exactly equal to this state down here. That should be rather surprising to you. After all, psi up here is the 1st qubit, and that's the 2nd and the 3rd, so the 3rd qubit appears not to have any dependence on psi whatsoever, whereas down here, it's the 3rd qubit that involves psi. Nonetheless, the way of verifying this identity is simply to substitute psi is equal to alpha 0 plus beta 1, and if you simply write out the 2 expressions and simplify them as much as you can, you'll see that these 2 different forms for the same state are in fact identical. Let me go through all the terms down here. It's convenient to separate them up into 4 different terms. Each of the 4 terms basically has the same form. Let's just look at this yellow term here first, and then we'll go through the other 3. So the yellow term, we've got Alice's 2 qubits are in the state 0, 0, plus 1, 1, while Bob's qubit is in the state psi. And in fact, the other 3 terms have a very similar form as well. Alice's 2 qubits here are in the state 0, 0, minus 1, 1. Bob's qubit is in the state z psi, and so on through the other 2 terms. Very similar. What this means is that if Alice performs a measurement with respect to this orthonormal basis of her two qubits, the two qubits in her possession, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, etc. Well, Bob's state, conditional on the four possible outcomes of this measurement, are as follows. In the first case, we see that Bob's conditional state would be psi. In the second case, we see that Bob's conditional state would be z times psi. In the third case, it's x times psi. And in the fourth case, it's xz times psi. What that means is that Bob can complete the teleportation protocol provided he can undo this transformation. All they have to do to complete the teleportation protocol then is for Alice, depending on which of the four measurement outcomes she gets, she simply sends that result as classical information over to Bob, and Bob applies the appropriate inverse operation. You might recall I earlier mentioned that in fact x squared and z squared were both equal to the identity. So in fact x and z are self-inverse. All Bob would need to do here is apply z again and he'd get the state psi back. He could apply x here and he'd get the state psi back. Or here he would first apply x and then he would apply z to get the state psi back. So regardless of the measurement outcome, Bob is able to recover the state psi. This is remarkable for a whole bundle of different reasons. First of all, remember that Alice doesn't know what the state psi is. She's got no idea. She's been given it by some other party. And we know that it's not possible for her to determine what that state is. No quantum measurement will give her complete information about those two amplitudes, alpha and beta. Nonetheless, communicating only two classical bits of information, she's able to complete the transmission of psi over to Bob. A second fact, which is quite remarkable, something I didn't mention, is that if you work out the probabilities for these four measurement outcomes, in each case the probability is 1/4. The reason why that's interesting is because it's 1/4 completely independent of what the state psi was. So if there was somebody eavesdropping on the classical communications channel between Alice and Bob, and they were, you know, they determined what that measurement result was, they would get no information whatsoever about the identity of the state psi. So in some sense, you know, this communication which Alice does to Bob, this classical communication, actually contains no information about the identity of psi, even though it's actually necessary to complete the teleportation protocol. I find that rather remarkable and rather intriguing. I can't offer you a good explanation for it. It's just the way the mathematics turns out. Yep? Put it this way. When Alice does that measurement locally, if you then calculate what Bob sees in his system and don't allow him access to Alice's measurement result, it's very easy to prove that there's no change whatsoever from Bob's point of view. He doesn't see any change locally in his system. There's no difference in any measurement. If for any measurement Bob can do at that point, he would get the same measurement statistics as if Alice had not done her measurement. Hang on. Conditional on Bob knowing Alice's measurement result, which he doesn't instantaneously, the state has not changed. Or I should perhaps say that the statistics of any measurement Bob can do have not changed. You can prove that. I haven't proved it. It takes a little bit of work to actually prove. Put it this way. Sorry? I would say that depending on who you ask and how they use those words, some people would say yes and some people would say no. But the key point from my point of view is that no faster than light information transmission is involved. Basically because of what I said, any measurement Bob could do afterwards, unless he knows what the measurement outcome Alice obtained, he doesn't obtain any different measurement statistics than he otherwise would. Yeah. I don't like the term action at a distance simply because, well, it's often used to imply something weird is going on when in fact I don't think anything weird is going on. So anyways, yeah. I realise it's a very common one. Alrighty, so that's quantum teleportation. I've described it in sort of the language of elementary quantum mechanics. You can also describe it using the quantum circuit language. And I'd just like to kind of put up quickly flash a view graph showing roughly how that works. I'm not going to go through this in any sort of detail. It's just yet another example of the quantum circuits in action. You know, basically, this yellow section here, well, you know, we're using this convention that the qubits start in the 0-0 state, so they better set up their initial state, the 0-0 plus 1-1, using some sort of quantum network, which they do here. And that's how Alice and Bob are presumed to be entangled in the quantum circuit model. In reality, or the way I've described it earlier, in fact, you know, somebody, Victor, would pre-prepare the state and share it. But for the purposes of using the quantum circuit model, I'll describe it this way. Then Alice performs her measurement, and rather than doing it directly in that basis of four states, the so-called Bell basis, she could instead do it using a quantum circuit and then a measurement in the computational basis. And then at the end of the day, depending on her measurement result, Bob performs some conditional operation over here on his qubit, either a conditional Z, a conditional X, or both, depending on the measurement outcomes. So that's just an example of the way quantum information processing operations can be rephrased in terms of the quantum measurement model. The details are not too important. What is more important, or what I would like to emphasize, this is a form of communication favored by Charles Bennett, or popularized by Charles Bennett, is the sort of resource trade-off that's implied by teleportation. It's an example of point three in my previous description of how quantum information theory is usually done. What you've got is two types of static resources, or static and dynamic resources in quantum mechanics. You've got one e-bit. What do I mean by one e-bit? I mean that shared state, the 0-0 plus 1-1, that Alice and Bob were presumed to pre-share. It's called an e-bit because it means entangled bit. They've also got two classical bits of communication that they're allowed to perform to communicate the measurement result from Alice to Bob. With these resources, they're able to simulate, using the quantum teleportation protocol, one qubit of communication. So in some sense, these information theoretic resources are greater than or equal to this set of information theoretic resources, or this class of processes, if you prefer, enables you to perform this class of processes. So you've got some sort of ordering on what's possible. And much of what quantum information theory is about, you know, quantifying all the various trade-offs that are involved in performing these different types of dynamical processes. And just to give you an example of the sorts of questions you might ask, you know, could you do it with fewer than two classical bits? Could you do it with less than one e-bit? What would happen, you know, is there some sort of trade-off involved between these two? If you were to allow more classical bits, might you be able to do it with fewer e-bits, or vice versa? What if you had some extra knowledge about the quantum state? These are all the sorts of questions which, well, many, many papers have been written on, and which form part of the core of quantum information theory, in, you know, studying all the different trade-offs that could possibly be performed. Okay, that's really as much as I want to say about quantum information theory. I'm going to finish up just by talking a little bit about a couple of loose ends in my discussion of quantum mechanics. Basically, there are two things I want to talk about. One is a very useful piece of notation known as the outer product. So what's an outer product? This is another example of von Neumann's dictum, in my opinion. But sometimes you just have to get used to things. So if you're given two vectors, psi and phi, you can define an operator or a matrix, psi phi, by the following expression. So the way to think about this, guys, is that it's a matrix. In particular, you might want to imagine that psi and phi are states of a qubit. And psi and phi maps this vector, gamma, to the following expression. Recall that phi times gamma, or phi gamma, is just a complex number. It's the inner product of the vector phi with the vector gamma. So you've got a complex number here multiplying a vector. So this satisfies all the appropriate conditions for a matrix. It takes as input a vector and produces as output a vector, and you can easily verify that it's a linear map. Not surprisingly, you know, some examples make this a heck of a lot clearer. The first example I'm going to give is perhaps the simplest. Imagine that you've got a qubit. So 0 and 1 are the two computational basis states of a qubit. And you know, how does this operator, 0, 1, act on an arbitrary state of the qubit, alpha 0 plus beta 1? Well, you take the inner product of 0 with alpha 0 plus beta 1, and of course you get alpha, and it simply multiplies 1. So the output from this matrix acting on this state is just alpha times 1. Another example is the Pauli sigma x operation, or the NOT gate. Recall that x acting on 0 gives you 1, and vice versa. It's then easy to verify that x can be written as a linear combination of two of these, where linear combinations of such outer product expressions act in the obvious way on states, namely that this linear combination of these two acting on a state gamma is just the corresponding linear combination of the individual terms acting on gamma. So, for example, to verify that this expression on the right-hand side really is the NOT operation, let's see how it acts on 0 and on 1. Well, if you act this expression on 0, well, we pick up from the first term the inner product of 0 with 0 is 1, and the inner product of 1 with 0 is 0, so it returns just the 1. And if we act this expression on the state 1, then we pick up nothing at all from the first term, because the inner product of 0 with 1, it vanishes. And the inner product of 1 with 1 is the unit, and therefore it returns 0. So it acts correctly on the 0 and the 1 terms, and it's by definition linear, and therefore this expression must be equal to the X matrix. All right. Basically, I've included that simply because the outer product notation is quite commonly used. And I just wanted to give you sort of a glimpse of it so you obtain some sort of a feeling for what the outer product is. The other thing I want to give you a glimpse of is the Schrödinger's equation. What we have here, you might recall that we've postulate 2, we described how closed quantum systems evolve in time. So what we said earlier was that a closed quantum system, its evolution is described by a unitary transformation. In other words, you know, the state at some later time is related to the initial state by some unitary matrix. Well, that's all well and good, but in fact quantum systems evolve in continuous time, or so we believe. So you might ask yourself, how do we describe the evolution of a quantum state in time, not, you know, using some sort of discrete time picture like this, but rather presumably through some sort of differential equation to describe the continuous time dynamics. And it turns out that there's an equivalent form of this postulate which works in continuous time. And I'll just very briefly explain what that is. In order to explain what that is, however, I need to just go through a little bit more linear algebra. I need to revisit Hermitian matrices. So what's a Hermitian matrix? Very similar to a unitary matrix in a lot of ways, or has many similar properties at least. A Hermitian matrix H is one such that H dagger is H itself. So let me give you an example of this. In fact, it's the Pauli X again, the NOT gate. If you take the dagger of X, the conjugate, Hermitian conjugate, well, when you take the dagger, you complex conjugate the entries, doesn't change anything. You take the transpose, doesn't change anything. So you get just X back again. So X is a good example of a Hermitian matrix. Just one other point I want to make about Hermitian matrices, which is important for physical reasons, for terminology which physicists often use, is that Hermitian matrices satisfy the so-called spectral theorem, namely that there exists an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors for any Hermitian matrix, and those eigenvectors have real eigenvalues. And this connects up to physics in a way I'll describe in a couple of minutes. But just as an example of the spectral theorem in action, let me go through the example of the NOT gate, the X. If we act x on the state 0 plus 1 over root 2, we easily see that we return the state 0 plus 1 over root 2. So this state is an eigenvector of x with eigenvalue plus 1. If we act x on the state 0 minus 1 over root 2, however, we get the state back, but now with an overall factor of minus 1 in front. So this state is an eigenvector of x with eigenvalue minus 1. So we have a orthonormal basis consisting of this state and this state of eigenvectors for this particular Hermitian matrix with real eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. How does this connect up with physics? I'll give you the revised form of postulate 2 now. What we have is the following postulate, and that is that the evolution of a closed quantum system is described by Schrödinger's equation. Schrödinger's equation has this form. It's I, that's the complex imaginary I, times d psi dt is equal to h psi, where h is some constant Hermitian matrix known as the Hamiltonian of the system. I'll explain how that connects with unitary operators and everything in a couple of minutes. What I first want to all do is emphasize that this H here is not the Hadamard matrix. I mean, I see some people smiling, but it can actually be quite frustrating if you don't determine this in some particular situation. A couple of times I know I've confused myself quite a bit. So that's the first point. You have to beware of context. The second thing is, well, you might ask yourself, how the heck in any given situation do we determine what H is? And the answer is that it's a very difficult problem. I've talked a little bit about how difficult a problem it has been to determine what the state space of a physical system is. Well, it's an even harder problem to determine what the Hamiltonian of a given physical system is. And much of, for example, a theory like quantum electrodynamics is really just writing down the Hamiltonian for the system or some equivalent description. So just a connection to the sort of terminology which physicists often use, which might be useful for you to see for later lectures. The eigenvectors of H are known as the energy eigenstates of the system, and the corresponding eigenvalues are known as the corresponding energies for those states. So when people talk about energy levels for quantum systems, this is what they're talking about. It's these eigenvectors and eigenvalues. So just... what's the physical interpretation? Well, not quite sure what the best way of answering that necessarily is. Sorry? Sure. I mean, yeah, there's certainly plenty of answers that could be given. For now, it's probably the simplest thing to do is just accept it as a definition. I mean, in practice, of course, the reason why we use this terminology is because it connects up with established ways of measuring energy in physical systems. There was a notion of energy that existed prior to quantum mechanics, and it turns out that notion of energy actually corresponds to this. But seeing why that's the case is not at all trivial. Okay, so as a simple example of the sort of Hamiltonian that occurs in many systems, you've got this example here. So it's an example for a single qubit. And the Hamiltonian, I'm going to write down, H, is just proportional up to some constant omega to the X matrix. And the energy eigenstates are just the eigenstates of the X operator, 0 plus 1 over root 2 and 0 minus 1 over root 2. And the corresponding energies are plus or minus omega. So what's the connection to the old form of postulate 2? Well, if you simply make a guess as to the solution of Schrödinger's equation, and you make this particular guess, so this is the matrix exponential of minus i h t, And so this psi naught is the initial state of the system at time t equals naught, and this psi of t is the solution you're guessing for the state of the system at time t. You substitute this guess into Schrodinger's equation, you'll find that you've actually written down a correct solution to Schrodinger's equation. So this is the solution, the unique solution. And, this should not be here. The appropriate unitary operator then to define, or the appropriate operator connecting the initial state to the final state, is the exponential of minus iht. And if you play around for a while, you'll be able to convince yourself that U is in fact a unitary matrix, and that's the connection. Hermitian, the reason why it's unitary is because H is Hermitian, and in fact you can go in both directions. If you take the log of U, you will get a Hermitian matrix. And thus you can write down, changing our notation slightly, that the final state of the system at time t is connected to the initial state of the system at time t equals zero by this particular unitary operator. And much of, quite a substantial part of those big thick books about quantum mechanics really is just figuring out how to take this particular matrix exponential. You guess a form for the Hamiltonian, figure out how to take this particular exponential, look to see what the experimental consequences are, and if it agrees with experiment, then you regard that as a confirmation of the fact that you've guessed the right Hamiltonian for the system. And that's a pretty good description of how we work in many particular situations. That's all I really wanted to say about this revised form of postulate 2 of quantum mechanics. Yep? Sorry?
Can we ask if quantum mechanics is discrete or
Perhaps the right way of answering that is to say that in some sense this revised form of postulate 2 is really more fundamental, because we believe that things do actually occur in continuous time. But the form of postulate 2 that's used by far most commonly in quantum information theory and quantum computation is the form that I originally gave, which is the reason why I gave it in that particular form. We tend to think in discrete time. I don't know, maybe that will change. But, yeah. Well, I'm not sure I'd lay my bets on that. But, that's the way in which physics is usually formulated. Of course, people have spent a lot of time speculating as to whether or not, you know, time is really discrete or continuous, but yeah, nobody knows. Okay. In any case, that's all I wanted to say about quantum information theory and about quantum mechanics, and I'll leave the floor open for questions.